It's KJZZ's Here and Now. Good morning. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Coming up this hour, Sheriff Joe Arpaio's contempt hearing, which has been off and on for more than 6 months, continues again tomorrow. The hearing's been full of drama, including Judge Murray Snow choosing to ask the sheriff his own questions. We'll get the perspective of Phoenix New Times columnist Stephen Lemons. Plus, we recently learned that a low percentage of Arizona's high school graduates are ready for the state's universities. Now it seems college graduates are as unprepared for the business world. What's being done right and what needs to change soon to get young people more ready for excelling in the workplace? Also, performer Hershey Felder is known for embodying legendary musicians like Gershwin. Now he's doing a one-man show as Irving Berlin in the Valley, and we'll ask him about it. We start today's program with Governor Doug Ducey's state land trust proposal for increasing funding for K-12 education in Arizona. The Center for the Study of Economic Liberty at ASU has just released a study on the proposal, and with me to talk about it is Scott Bollier, Executive Director of the Center. Scott, good morning.
Good morning, Steve. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for being with us. The study indicates the governor's plan is a good one for Arizona. Take us down some of the key points.
Sure, absolutely. So what I do in the study is take a look at endowment policies, which is the state land trust has set aside the lands that they've sold into a trust, investable assets, stocks and bonds. It's about $5 billion in value. And I take a look at what we've done in the recent past, what we're doing with policy now, and what it would look like if we embrace the governor's proposal going forward, or if we just kind of stuck with the status quo. Currently, we pay out 2.5% on the market value of the assets in the trust. So it's a pretty small amount of money. And if you look at other states like New Mexico, if you look at other states like North Dakota, we're not even close to them in terms of how much we're paying out. And what this means if we were to change our payout formula is more dollars for education. It could be up to $3 billion over the next 10 years going into schools, going into kids having opportunities at better technologies and more access to resources.
You note in the study that taxes won't have to be raised with the plan. Is the land trust plan enough for the long term, or should we just be focused on perhaps the next 5 to 10 years?
Well, if we got better policy implemented, if we went up and, you know, considered some higher level of payout, whether it's the 10-5 proposal of Governor Ducey, or if we just went with a 5% payout forever, there'd be a lot more dollars there. And my point is not that taxes will never go up to fund education, but maybe some of the drama that we're seeing in budgetary showdowns where you have these crises over $120 million cut could be softened a little bit because we actually are using a resource that has tremendous untapped value effectively. Not only do they have $5 billion in trust, there's $70 billion of land that is not being used appropriately either. Think of what we could do with this for our kids now. So there's a strong message in the study of act now, because why not? You know, why sit on assets for some unforeseen, unknowable future?
Well, the critics, including State Treasurer Jeff DeWitt, have said, well, that's what it's there for, and that's what the Constitution created. So do you think this is a worthwhile issue to change the Constitution, have voters decide to do that?
I do. I think if you look at the origins of the land endowment, they're 100 years old. They're out of step a little bit with where we are and where optimal endowment policy is. Universities around the country pay out 4% on their endowment. Private endowments pay out 5%. We're at just 2.5%. If we could just get this in line with what other states and the universities are doing, it'd be a lot more dollars coming out and going towards education now. And there's an argument that the future is probably going to be a lot better today. So if that indeed is the case, and almost every economist agrees on that, more should be going into kids right now, right at this moment.
Scott, my concern on that last point, though, is that a lot of economists, many of whom I respect, also didn't have us facing one of the worst recessions in history. So we can't always look ahead and be positive about the future.
That's right. But we shouldn't look ahead and assume it's going to be exactly the same as it is now. If you were to look back 50 years at what problems faced Arizonans 50 years ago, it was things like air conditioning and you know, just difficulty making ends meet and not necessarily having 3 square meals on the table. That's still true for many today. But we've come a really long way thanks to economic progress. It's one of the real iron laws that economists all generally agree on is that we will have more growth in the future. So if we're going to have growth, the next generation is going to be much better than today's. So maybe be a little more aggressive in the present.
Is there also reason to believe that Arizona's land will be worth more in the future?
There is, although the interesting thing there is that the land that's being held by the trust is, maybe accruing at a 3 or 4% yield per year. If we could sell that land and put it in the endowment, we could be investing it in stocks, which historically average somewhere between 6, 8, maybe even 10% per year, depending on how you look at it. So there's an opportunity cost to sitting on all of that land, and I think that that's really an important resource that I focus mainly on the endowment piece in the study, but it's $70 billion, and other states have gotten out of the business of holding all of their land. Nevada has almost no land remaining. They've sold it off, and they have a more robust trust. New Mexico, which I talk a lot about, also has been more aggressive. So they're able to pay about $1,000 from their trust per kid. We're able to pay about $50 per kid. That's a big difference.
Scott, I wonder at this point, though, based on what you're saying, Governor Ducey's plan goes down in terms of the percentage. We sort of start off, as you mentioned, 10 and 5, and then we end up down at 2.5 at one point, if I remember correctly. Why not just stay at the high percentage?
I personally would prefer that. The plan, the 10-5 plan that's out there, is a 10-year plan, and then in fact it sunsets to zero. We'll have to make a decision in 2026 about where do we want that rate. Nobody's going to accept zero. I'd be comfortable going 10-5 and then just staying at 5 and putting it on autopilot after that. That 10%, which has become kind of controversial in political discourse right now, I think of as perhaps correcting for a recent wrong. If you look at the 10 years prior to 2014, those kids suffered through a really bad financial crisis and have not been getting fair treatment under the endowment. It's only been about 1.8% per year in payouts. Maybe we can make up for that a little bit with that 10% for the next 5, but after that, I think 5% puts us in line with New Mexico. It's consistent with private endowment management, and would be a lot better than today.
Scott, finally, obviously invited you on to talk about the study specifically, but I want to come back to sort of the broader question of this, though. Based on the priority that most people feel K-12 education should be, and based on what you're saying about the land trust proposal and the fact that maybe taxes could be raised in the future, why not go all in right now? Why not decide to go land trust, maybe raise certain taxes, and also perhaps Republican lawmakers and their appeal of the lawsuit related to past funding for K-12?
Well, I'm not an expert on what the exact ideal level of educational spending is. I know that we're very low, 48th in the country right now. This is just one piece of figuring out what that optimal amount of spending is. And in my opinion, it's low-hanging fruit. This is the most obvious source of dollars we should be tapping. And if we added to it, it could perhaps make some of these other ways of funding education more acceptable. There'd be a little more breathing room, and it wouldn't be just this nastiness that we've seen in recent years related to tight budgets and no money. So I don't know what it implies exactly for whether taxes should be higher or lower, but I know that it's something that's just sitting there, and that's a real shame for kids.
Scott Beilear is Executive Director of the Center for the Study of Economic Liberty at ASU. Scott, thank you.
Thanks, Steve.
It's KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. For another perspective on Governor Ducey's land trust proposal and this report, I'm joined by Andrew Morrill, President and CEO of the Arizona Education Association. Andrew, good morning to you.
Thanks. Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
So let's get your take on this. I mean, we've talked a little bit in the past about Governor Ducey's proposal. Were you convinced at all by what Scott had to say?
Well, I think in looking at the way the report is represented, that there are some conclusions the report draws that warrant some scrutiny, at least, and maybe even some challenge. The idea that money will be worth less in the future, so we should spend more of the endowment now, sort of negates the very philosophy of savings and prudent management of an endowment, after all, that was never intended to be the primary funding source of the state's public education system. Furthermore, the trust by law, the endowment, is supposed to follow a prudent investment and disbursement strategy that actually protects it from decreasing in value due to inflation. So I had trouble connecting that premise to the findings of the report. I think that the author of the report can be gratified to know that virtually every serious education funding discussion going on right now in the policy arena involves the use of trust lands to some degree. The Democrats' plan does not, others do. A lot of this talk is very fluid right now, as you know and can imagine. You have general fund revenue that's available now that wasn't available when the budget was passed. And you have a lot of people coming around to the idea of doing something with trust lands, but I think we've got to be very careful about how cavalier we are with using this endowment.
That's why I wonder about this limited time frame. And also, I want to ask you the same thing I asked Scott as well. Why not go all in on this? It almost seems like finally, almost everyone agrees that the numbers that we see about the state underfunding education are true. So why not sort of play all our cards right now, or at least many of the cards?
Well, I think we should be, as a matter of fact. I mean, we've got to think about the reauthorization of Prop 301. Voters passed that in the year 2000. It was the voter action and the legislature's four-year rejection of what the voters had ordered and voted on and approved that actually led to the lawsuit in the first place. I think there's a great opportunity here. The governor's office has really stepped up the role of leading, or at least being a catalyst of a lot of these ed funding discussions. I credit Governor Ducey with coming out and joining others, and he was one of the earlier voices to say it, with saying our public school students do not have enough funding supporting them. You have legislative leadership willing to admit that. We are a low-tax state, and in fact, the report tries to suggest that in not ramping up the payout from the endowment, we're somehow denying funding for today's students. The education community has a very different take on that. If you look back at 25 years of tax cuts that led to education funding reductions during the recession, I mean, yes, the recession had a role, but listen, we've gotten here one legislative session at a time. We've cut out full-day K funding. We've cut out inflation funding for 4 years, as I said. Mm. We've wiped out a majority of instruction and capital funding, and we've done reductions to the base level. It was through the legislative process that we began to deny today's students the funding that they need.
Is the land trust proposal enough now? By that I mean, can that start momentum in this direction, do you think? Or if, in fact, that goes forward, the governor gets the legislature to put it on the ballot, voters approve it, do you think that ends the momentum right there? Do you think people will then say, well, let's give it a few years, see if it works?
Well, I worry about that. That's why I think, to your point, we really need a comprehensive conversation about this. There is available funding in the general fund because of economic growth right now. There's a lot of conversation, by the way, about deploying some of that available funding into our public schools, and that's a good thing. And then the trust land conversation, because as we know, that cannot happen without a vote, but that certainly is a part of this overall education funding discussion. By itself, it's problematic. If you really tried to do something about all the cuts that have been made, with the single source being the endowment, you would raid it, and you would do what other states have done, which is turn it over too quickly and then lose it ultimately. But I don't really think anybody's proposing that. I think the governor's office has heard the education community talk about the importance of avoiding a funding cliff. And even though 10 years may seem like a long time, you have to remember that the most of the costs that school districts incur are ongoing. We need teachers. We need all those other roles beyond teachers that make a school district run and open the building and build the community around which our students learn. We have facilities that represent ongoing costs. So the need is going to be there. I do take exception with the report's conclusion, rather loosely drawn, that the quality of life will be better in the future. The middle class is losing earning power right now. They're losing their savings. The recession cost a lot of the middle class their homes. They're racking up debt, and higher education is harder and harder to afford. I found that to be a very curious and sort of casually offered statement, that life's going to be better in the future, so kids will probably be better off and maybe need less education funding then. I didn't quite understand that.
Well, Andrew, thanks for your take. Andrew Morrill is president and CEO of the Arizona Education Association. Always appreciate your time.
Thank you very much.
And still to come on Here and Now, we'll talk with Dr. Sybil Francis of the Center for the Future of Arizona. And then later this hour, Phoenix New Times' Stephen Lemons with his take on the Sheriff Joe Arpaio contempt hearing. Stay with us.
KJZZ is supported by Riley Carlock and Applewhite, a business law firm serving local and national clients in e-discovery and document review, banking and finance, litigation, and many other areas of the law. Details at rcalaw.com.
This is Here and Now on KJZZ. We'll bring you the latest international news from the BBC on NewsHour today at 1. Taking a look at Valley traffic right now, there's a crash on Scottsdale Road near the Loop 101. That's got the eastbound 101 exit at Scottsdale Road closed. Eastbound on I-10 at Riggs Road, that's down to one lane there due to an earlier vehicle fire, and you can expect some delays. Around the state, it's 54 degrees in Flagstaff, 63 in Prescott, 72 degrees in Casa Grande, 68 in Tucson, and 84 in Yuma. Well, KJZZ thanks David for donating his Chrysler to support his favorite shows. You can donate your ride too by visiting cars.kjzz.org, and thanks. It's mostly sunny right now in Phoenix and 75 degrees at 11:22.
You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. We recently learned that an alarmingly low percentage of Arizona high school graduates are well poised to succeed in the state's universities. Now a report by the Center for the Future of Arizona shows the state is fairly well positioned to meet the needs of employers who need workers with mid-level skills. These are the ones that require at least some college, an associate's degree, or some advanced technical training. According to the report, mid-skilled jobs are also vulnerable if new innovations make it possible to substitute technology for human labor, or if they can be outsourced overseas. How serious is the situation? What can be done to turn the tide? Joining me to discuss it is one of the founders of the Center for the Future of Arizona and its current executive director, Sybil Francis. Welcome. Thanks for being here.
It's great to be here, Steve. Thank you.
Are we in a chicken and egg situation as it relates to higher paying jobs, or what we'd call higher skilled jobs, in the sense that if potential employers don't see Arizona's education system as strong, they won't come. But if they do, they will. And then the momentum sort of builds.
I think you really hit the nail on the head. We are at an important inflection point in the state. Historically, as I think we all know, we have not had a very diversified economy. And certainly to support a diversified and healthy economy, we need a high education attainment level. And if we look at the numbers, we know that nationally as well as in Arizona, we need about 68% of the population to have some kind of degree past high school. Mm-hmm. Currently, Arizona stands at 37%. So I think you're right. We do have a gap in terms of meeting our needs right now.
Is that another thing that sort of puts us behind the eight ball? Is there, obviously, as people who live in Arizona, we're focused very much on the state, but you're someone who has lived other places. You have obviously looked into this. Are we as behind as it sometimes seems?
Well, I think the entire country is struggling with these questions, absolutely. And I know we sometimes are very critical of ourselves in Arizona, but I think it's important to recognize that the economy is changing, you know, in the United States and around the globe, and it's important to realize that many places struggle with this. I think what makes the difference between places that struggle and don't succeed and those who struggle and do succeed is being able to step back, take a look at the big picture, and assess what we need to do. And I think we're at a good inflection point in Arizona. And that's the point we were trying to make in our Vision 2025 report, which is that this is an important time to be stepping back and taking a look at the big picture and thinking about the future.
One of the points that I took from it, even when the center got started and we talked to your colleague, Dr. Kaur, about this, it was the feeling that how do you get people feeling like they can play an active role in sort of turning the momentum, swimming against the tide, whatever it may be, whatever pat phrase I can use there. What does that have? How do we get people excited about that? Or do they have to sort of have that inherently and feel like there is hope to make the change?
I think there's responsibility at every level. There's the responsibility of our leaders. There's the responsibility of our institutions, the business community, the government, the philanthropic community, the education community, and also individuals, neighbors, families. And I think at each level, we need to think about setting goals and having a vision to work towards. And then once we have goals, then we can work together to meet those goals.
When these groups get together, I feel like we can't be afraid of conflict. And it almost feels like we hear a lot about that when people are at the table, and if they're not as agreeable, then there are troubles there. And I guess I feel like when you're facing these big issues, it's important that people come with an open mind and are able to, as long as it's respectful, are able to argue about these things.
Well, one of the things we very much emphasize at the Center for the Future of Arizona, and one of the sections in our report is addresses the Arizona we have. Who are we? What are the data points that we need to understand? And once you can have a common understanding of where we are, I think that does tend to reduce the stress and really highlight both the opportunities as well as some of the challenges that we have. So, for example, relative to workforce development, we know that in Arizona, Arizona, and the census reports just came out about this, we're at about 82% historically of national average income. That's down over the last couple of decades from the mid-90s in Arizona. So people are feeling these problems in their wallets, and I think if you can talk about them in a very personal way, that way people will understand that we really need to think about what to do about this.
It seems like after the Great Recession, many people in sort of what we call the middle class have really sort of worried about, okay, I even heard President Obama on Marketplace last night talking about this, saying that, yes, jobs have come back. We had a good recovery, but wages are not going up. And obviously, again, that's not unique to Arizona, but are there certain things that come to mind for you that sort of at least have us going in the right direction as that relates? Is it just getting more people educated? Is it, but there have to be jobs to go along with those people who are getting those degrees.
Well, it's a fact that educational attainment, both for an individual as well as a state or a nation, is directly correlated to many positive indicators. So income, negatively correlated with our incarceration rates, positively correlated with tax rates. So it is a bit of a chicken and egg in the sense that you need to have education to have the jobs, but will the jobs come without the education? I firmly believe, and I think it's been shown, that if you increase your educational attainment, the jobs will come. Because people also are really much working for themselves these days, creating their own companies. So if you have an educated workforce, they'll go out and create their own small businesses.
It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix, talking with Sybil Francis. She is the executive director of the Center for the Future of Arizona. Sybil, though there would need to be variations on this, and there's no exact formula, is there a formula that seems to work when we think about being more innovative? Innovation is such an important word, and how can Arizona sort of lead in that as opposed to maybe being on the back end?
Well, you're asking exactly the right question, particularly when it comes to this question of workforce development and education. You know, I like to say that if we're not getting the results we want in our educational outcomes, we can't just keep doing the same thing and expecting a better result. I will be the first to say that our education system, both in Arizona and nationally, has accomplished tremendous things, but the world doesn't stand still, and our education system can't stand still either. So we really need to think innovatively. And what does that mean in education?
Right.
What we really need to think about is a future where we move away from a one-size-fits-all education model. We often talk about this idea that we're based on an industrial era model where every student is essentially receiving the same kind of education. We know that individuals are going to vary in their interests and in their talents and where they want to go. So we need to make sure that we ensure that every student, absolutely every student, receives an excellent education. At the same time, we also need to give students some choice. And I think we see some of that beginning now, but we really need to figure out how do we personalize the educational pathway for students.
And as this changes, as you mentioned, things becoming more personalized, or at least the potential for that, when vision is involved and that word is invoked, that would seem to imply patience to me. And yet most of us, especially in these major issues, don't want to wait. It needs to be done today or at least the next day. So how can we blend the ideas we've discussed into this idea that people, okay, as long as we're moving in the right direction, that is good because these problems are not solved overnight?
I'm not sure if you're asking me if we think we should be patient, but I think we probably shouldn't be patient.
Okay.
We should be asking a lot of our system, and I think we need to really modernize our education system in many ways. I think there's signs that that's starting to happen, but I think we need to become more aggressive. To name a local institution, Arizona State University, I think they have shown that it's possible to be very innovative in education. I think we need to take some of that same spirit into the K-12 system.
At this point, I will mention that your spouse is the president of Arizona State University. Not that's why you made the point, but final question for you. Arizona has a much larger number of transplants than most other states do. I presume that comes with positives and negatives. How do you look at that? And how do you look at that as far as making the change?
Well, being a transplant myself, I see that as a great positive. In fact, I will often tell people who maybe are native to Arizona how exciting it is to be here, because we often focus on some of the problems and challenges we face. But I will tell you, I have never had a dull day in the 13 years I've lived here, and I'm really high on Arizona. I think we have huge potential. And if you have a good idea and you can work hard at it, you can actually get it done. And that's why I think we can do this.
Sybil Francis is Executive Director of the Center for the Future of Arizona. Pleasure to have you here. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much, Steve. Great to be here.
This is KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Following a five-month recess, Sheriff Joe Arpaio's civil contempt of court proceedings got underway again late last month. The hearing has included Judge Murray Snow asking Arpaio directly if he knew whether the judge had been the target of an investigation. In the spring, Arpaio and Chief Deputy Jerry Sheridan actually admitted they'd violated the court's orders. We've also seen former Arpaio attorneys testify during the hearing, and there's no doubt a lot more to come when the hearing resumes tomorrow. One of the close observers of the sheriff in recent years has been Phoenix New Times columnist Stephen Lemons, who joins me now. Stephen, good morning. Thanks for being with us.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Okay, so how would you describe the hearing so far without four-letter words? Is it a stretch to call it kind of Shakespearean, but there's like a mix of comedy and tragedy?
Yeah, you know, I guess you, if, especially if the tragedy is Macbeth. I mean, you know, he's, I would say, you know, Arpaio has been severely damaged by this, you know, this latest round. I think he was damaged in the first round of testimony in the contempt trial in April when he had to admit to investigating a federal judge. And now, you know, he's on the stand trying to distance himself from it and say that he, you know, wasn't really investigating the judge, but, you know, the evidence shows otherwise.
Well, he certainly seems weakened, and yet he seemed weakened a few years ago as well, the last time he won re-election. If this doesn't turn out in a way that actually includes him having some firm punishment, are there still voters who will put him in office again?
Sure. I mean, you know, that's the unfortunate thing about Arpaio is that there's a kind of cult of personality around him, and that cult of personality usually earns him at least 30-40% in the polls, and the rest he can make up. So, you know, that's the unfortunate part about it. However, I would say that I think that it's, you know, the damage will be especially, you know, apparent even to the people who are not following it closely if there's a referral for criminal contempt. And if that happens, you know, you have a sheriff, you know, up for possible criminal violation. So I think that's a serious matter. And I think that's something where some people who may have backed Arpaio in the past will have some reservations about doing so in 2016.
You know, Stephen, it's not like we're unique here. This case is unique. Arizona's had a lot of other elected officials facing interesting questions legally. But it does seem like with the sheriff, the one who's supposed to be the big enforcer of the county's laws, this just seems to put Arizona in another bad light.
Yeah, and it's something that, you know, is persistent, you know, over the course of Arpaio's career. This isn't the first time he's gone after a judge. As you well know, he went after, you know, Judge Gary Donahoe in the Superior Court and has gone after, you know, other elected officials, retaliated against his enemies. I agree. I don't think it's good for, you know, Arizona's image. But, you know, voters have always caught into that tough guy image he has. And in this case, I think, you know, he may have stepped over the line, or I know he stepped over the line. Whether or not he faces, you know, the punishment in the public arena is one thing. But I think, you know, as far as like his punishment or possible criminal referral is in the hands of one person. That's federal judge G. Murray Snow. So, you know, political and federal judges are appointed for life. They're not beholden to political interests. So, you know, Arpaio is not one of those things where, you know, oh, well, maybe the U.S. attorney is, you know, not willing to go after him in an election year or something along those lines. No, this is totally up to Murray Snow. As far as the civil punishment he will receive and whether or not it's referred to a possible criminal prosecution, and I think it's the latter is quite likely.
How do you think Judge Snow has handled this? I presume he was uncomfortable sort of being put in the spotlight when he questioned the sheriff, but do you think he's run a tight courtroom? Has he run this in a way that it's trying to be non-controversial?
I think he's been, you know, very even-handed, and he's been critical of both the plaintiffs and the defense counsel at different times. You know, he's kept it from becoming some kind of circus, and the allegations that are there are very serious. And, you know, it's important that, you know, the federal judiciary or any judiciary is free from intimidation. And this is what Arpaio is accused of, attempting to gin up some kind of conspiracy theory against the court, not following the court's orders, you know, over a series of years, and being defiant of the court over a series of years. So we're going to, you know, if we're going to live in a system of laws, Sheriff Arpaio has to abide by those laws as well. And the people who, you know, are his fans and love him are going to have to accept that even Arpaio has limits in what he can and can't do.
It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix, talking with Phoenix New Times columnist Stephen Lemons. Stephen, do you think, you know, the sheriff's had not a great relationship with many publications, including New Times, over the years. Do you think of him as an easy target? I guess not to get too human interest on you here, but do you have any feelings for him in the sense, like, you feel bad for him now that he's sort of weakened on the stand, or is there a feeling that he is the sheriff and he has done wrong?
I have a feeling he's the sheriff and he's done wrong.
Okay.
You know, but over a series of years, he's done wrong. You know, of course, I have to admit the fact that he put my former employers in jail a few years back. You could say that I would agree that biases me to some degree. However, that the facts are the facts. I mean, Arpaio has gone off. He's misused money in his office. He's there have been, you know, deaths in his jails, which are horrendous, such as the one of Marty Atencio. He's remained callous and indifferent to that, and he's used his authority in what I consider to be illegal ways, and I think he needs to be held accountable. And it's not just, you know, me who thinks that. You know, it's like there are a lot of other people who think that, and all, as well as, you know, to some degree, even his own employees and his own lawyer. I mean, his, you know, lawyer Tim Casey testified in court about hearing about this. You know, one of the investigations, or Arpaio was ginning up against Judge Snow, and he said he thought it was vindictive, and that's his own, or that's his own lawyer speaking. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's, you know, the guy who was paid to defend him. His own employees have described how they went to him and expressed reservations about investigating the judge, and that they were spending too much money on it. Even his, you know, his chief deputy Sheridan said that they spent $250,000 on one investigation of the judge. I think it probably is a lot higher than that, but nevertheless, it was out of RICO funds. Some of it was federal funds. His employees, you know, went to one, a captain went to him and said, "Hey, you know, I think we're spending way too much money on this, and we're depleting our RICO funds, you know, which are funds that they have from asset forfeiture and other things, and they can use them on law enforcement." And Arpaio said, "I'm not going to use the four-letter word," but Arpaio, you know, allegedly told him, "Get the effing money, you know, I don't care, you know, I'm the sheriff." And so, you know, that's a different portrait of Arpaio, one who's essentially drunk on power and feels like he can do anything he wants, including, you know, investigate a federal judge or the president of the United States if he feels, you know, like it.
We have about 30 seconds left, and I've got to get your just a very quick reaction. You did a lot of reporting on Pinal County Sheriff Paul Babiou when he had to drop out of his previous congressional race, and now he's running again. Do you think voters will have short memories?
They may have short memories, but let's put it this way. All it will take is one mailer from one of his Republican opponents with some of the cheesy shots he put on dating websites, and he'll be done. You know, I just, that's a rural county. They need to be reminded of it, and they will be reminded of it.
Phoenix New Times columnist Stephen Lemons. Stephen, thanks.
Yeah, thank you.
Still to come on Here and Now, we'll talk about the Arizona Commission on the Arts AZ Art Worker Initiative, and we'll meet performer Hershey Felder. Stay with us.
KJZZ is supported by MidFirst Private Bank, offering strategically sound wealth management strategies tailored to your needs and a full range of custom lending solutions. More at midfirstprivatebank.com. Member FDIC.
Good morning, it's KJZZ's Here and Now on 91.5 and streaming at KJZZ.org. Mostly sunny and getting somewhat warmer for the next several days. Yesterday's high in the valley was just 80 degrees. Today we'll see 87 and up to 94 for tomorrow. Eastbound on the Loop 101 freeway in Scottsdale Road, the Scottsdale Road exit is closed due to a rollover collision, or a collision, I should say, on Scottsdale Road. Eastbound Loop 101, the Scottsdale Road exit. It closed there. Stay with us at 12 for NPR's Here and Now. Today we'll hear about a last-minute flurry of bills being signed in California, including right-to-die legislation and restrictions on paparazzi using drones, and the latest on the escalating Russian military involvement in Syria. Here and Now from Boston starts at noon. Mostly sunny and 75 degrees right now in Phoenix at 11:42.
This is KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Arizona's relationship with our neighbors in Mexico has received a lot of attention in recent years, but most of it's been focused on either economic development and cooperation or immigration reform and border fences. But what about art? The Arizona Commission on the Arts will present a series of artist workshops and artist-led community conversations in Douglas on Saturday and Sunday as part of its AZ Art Worker Initiative. To learn more, I'm joined by the Commission's Artist Programs Coordinator, Cassandra Hernandez, and visual artist Ana Teresa Fernandez, who is currently touring Arizona as part of a residency with ASU's Performance in the Borderlands Initiative. Welcome to you both. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having
Thank
us.
You.
So, Cassandra, explain to us how AZ Art Worker got started. It's just a couple of months old, right?
Yes, so we received a grant back in August from a foundation in Connecticut, the Emily Hall Tremaine Foundation, to pilot a new artist-to-artist professional development program. And this program is designed to facilitate dialogue, knowledge sharing between Arizona artists, their national and international peers, residents of Arizona communities. And we're working in three communities this year. We're going to be working with artists in Douglas, in Tucson, and in Phoenix. And this is a new way for the commission to invest in artists as a foundation of Arizona's art sector.
How do artists communicate? I know this is a huge question, but we all communicate in certain ways. And artists, when they get together, certainly they may not be on the same plane in terms of the type of art they practice, but is it important to get that conversation going, that collaboration, especially when we consider how different people sometimes perceive us in certain parts of Arizona and closer to the border? Is it important to break down those walls that people have created?
Absolutely. And I feel like, you know, we have so many artists doing very impressive work in Arizona, artists who are working in community contexts, who are advancing very important conversations about the challenges that we face as a state, who are organizing with other sectors, with other community members to advance social change. And so AZ Art Worker is a way to recognize the very dynamic system in which artists operate and to create a professional development investment that matches those very dynamic needs that artists have to do their work.
Ana Teresa, do you like to communicate with other artists, or do you communicate sort of through your art?
I think it has to happen both ways, you know, and I think in order for me to communicate my artwork more broadly, I have to listen to the community and pay really close attention. And I think that the artwork becomes an echoing or an extension of the voices of the community themselves. So all I think you're doing more of a translation of sorts, a visual translation of voices in a much more abstract way, perhaps.
Regardless of how the viewer may see a piece of art, how important is it, and is there always a message in the art that someone does? Because it has somehow come through their soul and their mind to really create this thing. So there has to be, even if, let's say, I see it and I don't exactly, I'm not on the same plane on the message, there is the message, right?
Yes. I mean, that depends from artist to artist. And I have, I'm very much inspired by indifferences, not indifferences, by differences in terms of possibilities within gender politics, social politics, cultural politics. And so for me, my message is always one of trying to shorten the gap between these differences. But I think that message is definitely can come across spiritually, intellectually, psychologically, in so many different, it can manifest itself in so many different ways.
And Cassandra, how can AZ Art Workers sort of get these things out more into the public so the public understands what Ana Teresa was saying? So it's not sort of, I think there are some people who, even if they love the art and they appreciate it, they may in fact be intimidated to some extent. Maybe they're not quite getting it. So I wonder if AZ Art Worker can help with that.
Absolutely. Is Your Worker works in multiple ways. We are, on one hand, creating access to artists to have high-quality professional development opportunities, often in areas that don't, really have contact with visiting artists or don't have perhaps, regular training opportunities outside of, formal environments like colleges and universities. So we are working with partner organizations in these communities to provide a steady presence. Mm-hmm. And we're very fortunate that we're working with two Arizona State University initiatives, as you mentioned, ASU Performance in the Borderlands, and then also ASU Art Museum and their artist residency program. And they've generously provided access to the artists that they're bringing to Phoenix. Artists like Ana Teresa, who is here all week doing a statewide residency. And so we have an opportunity to bring these artists to other communities, create new conversations, create trainings, and then really invest in new communities of practice, new networks, new relationships, which is ultimately how new work happens, right? We want to infuse and inspire new conversations and then also create visibility about the important work that artists do in our Arizona communities.
Those new conversations and maybe the perception that, that people have that they think we're more different than we really are.
Yeah, and if I can jump in quickly, Steve, I think that one of the important jobs in which the Arizona Arts Commission as well as Performance in the Borderlands are doing is, you know, I think part of my job is to actually go into different parts of the community, whether it's high schools or, you know, the College of Phoenix College, and or I was I had a lecture up in Flagstaff with NAU, but to go into different sectors and actually just explain my method, my process and the method in which I go through so they can further understand mm-hmm. the language of art, because I think so much of how we're taught today in our education is about right and wrong. And I think the artistic process is so much more expansive, and it's so much about the imagination and capturing people's imagination and recontextualizing how we see things. And so allowing for possibility of thought, allowing for possibility of furthering that imagination. And so we just walk, I literally just walk through this process in which I can maybe like a sort of braille, a visual braille in which I can lead people through how they can actually experience art and see it and understand it, because it's not a right and wrong experience. As you were saying, you can become afraid of it. And it's more like holding someone's hand and coming closer so you can have the experience of smelling the flower and having just a visceral experience.
Well, the way you described that was so beautiful. And I'm curious about this idea of your comfort level with that communication, because the phrases you used are not phrases that come naturally to people necessarily. This is a concept you've had going through your mind for a while.
Well, I think from my own personal experience of having grown up with very little creative or artistic process as a way of inculcating education. You know, I went to a private Catholic school in which the process was right and wrong. Mm. And so I was never asked to have a perspective on something. I was never asked an opinion about what I felt or what my experience was in relationship to a piece of art or a piece of literature. It was always like the cliff notes. I need to know what this means. And I think art is so not that. It's not about what it necessarily needs to me, but what it feels to you, what arises within you, what provokes you. Mm-hmm. And you can sometimes smell or feel or hear a sound when you're looking at a painting, or, you know, like how music just moves you. I think that visual art can definitely do that.
And absolutely. And I want to add to that, that one of the goals of this program is to also create a conversation in Arizona about the value of arts and culture, you know, and I personally feel that art and culture is how we make meaning about the world around us, how we make sense of our daily lives. And it's a way for us to reveal to ourselves our desires, our fears, our affections, our contradictions, possibilities. And I think that art allows us to connect with ourselves, with others, and then also to the ideas that shape our reality, you know, in our social world.
God, I wish we had a lot more time. Cassandra Hernandez is the Arizona Commission on the Arts Artist Programs Coordinator. Ana Teresa Fernandez, currently touring Arizona as part of a residency with ASU's Performance in the Borderlands Initiative. I didn't even get a chance to ask her about Barrando La Frontera. Maybe another time. Thanks so much.
They can come and see it at 6 p.m. at Phoenix Art Museum. I'll talk about it.
Terrific. There. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Steve.
Thank you.
You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Actors often become associated with a particular character, or at least a type of character. Some are cast as the friend in a romantic comedy, or the gangster in a mob movie, or the too-good-to-be-true defendant in a legal thriller. Actor and pianist Hershey Felder has had a successful run on stage portraying legendary musicians, from Chopin and Beethoven to George Gershwin. Starting tomorrow night and running through October 25th, he'll play Irving Berlin for Arizona Theater Company. Berlin's probably best known for composing God Bless America and White Christmas, the latter of which he wrote at the Arizona Biltmore. Hershey Felder, why did turning yourself into Irving Berlin appeal to you as a performer and a musician?
Well, actually, it didn't. Surprisingly enough, I didn't think it was something I was correct for. I didn't think it was the kind of music that I could bring something to. It's quite a negative way to start off an interview, but it's true. I was being pushed by a number of people in the theater industry, and then ultimately Irving Berlin's daughters met with me. I met with them. And, you know, there was something about it, just as though, just study a little bit more, look at a little bit more into his life. And as I said to the daughters the other day, because we had a communication yesterday by email, we communicate often, I said, I've become a better man because of your father, and most certainly a better artist. And there is such a depth to who this man was. There is a depth to his music that I didn't know. I didn't know about. I didn't think was relevant. I didn't think was important. I thought he was sort of an American jingle writer. You know, but that's the snob, the sort of Beethoven Chopin snob talking. And boy, was I whipped good, you know. When I dug into this life and when I really began to understand his music, how he accomplished it, and also what he did as a patriot of America, blown away, I think is the right term, and I'm so honored to play this man every single night.
So ultimately, now that you've arrived at that point, can you give us a couple of moments that really stand out to you, both as a performer and just in the research you did about him as a person? You alluded to it, but are there a couple of examples you could provide?
Well, you know, people don't know much about God Bless America other than it seems like a folk song that sadly or, you know, defiantly... Americans sang on staircases of courthouses and in Washington, D.C. on 9/11 and then subsequent anniversaries. And then as I dug into the history of it, how it was written, why it was written, when it was written, but more relevantly, that the Berlins have never made a cent from it, that Irving Berlin donated every single penny to the Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts of America, to something called the God Bless America Fund. To think a song that actually feels like an American, I would say a national anthem that's not the national anthem, or a heartfelt anthem for the country, to have never, that the composer never saw a cent from it because he donated it to a cause he believed in, is really a remarkable thing just to begin with in terms of understanding who this man was and what was important to him. And when I discussed this with the daughters, they said, oh, it's absolutely true. This wasn't a put-on. It wasn't for publicity. It wasn't so that he could get attention. He really believed that this country gave him everything that he had, and anything that he could give back, he would.
What you do is so multi-pronged, it almost seems incredible to someone like me who cannot play an instrument, cannot act, and is a pretty good researcher, I guess I'll say that. But I feel like you have to be the performer, but you also have to know so much about the person you're portraying. Is there a part of it that ends up being so worthwhile once you hit the stage? Is there a point where in the course of research and in the course of learning more of the music where you feel like, yeah, okay, I'm not really sure how well this one is going to work? Or again, because you said you weren't overly inspired to play Berlin, did you feel inspired to play Gershwin or some of the classical folks you mentioned as well?
Well, I felt inspired to play Berlin once I knew what I was dealing with. I wasn't inspired to to originate the show, so to speak. But once I actually got into it, boy, did I get inspired. And it's the same with all of these characters. You know, I was very, I mean, the dream was to play Chopin. So when I actually did, what fun was it to go and live in his shoes in Europe and to see his original scores and to deal with historians and the music. And I mean, that the music is always the beginning and end of the whole thing. There is always inspiration to tell a wonderful story, an honest story. So the inspiration is always there. When it comes to the stage, you know, the inspiration is really the responsibility. Once the work is done, and it, you know, it doesn't get done for a while, because once you're in front of an audience, that's actually when the work begins. But once the research work is done and you know more or less what your script will be and you've chosen your music and so on and so forth, the inspiration is really the responsibility to both the public, the character, and history, to tell the story fairly, truly, and honestly. And so it becomes less of an inspiration than a responsibility. And I think I thrive on responsibility. I enjoy that. I am inspired by the stories, but it's not the sort of loose inspiration, you know, running around the room going, oh my goodness, this feels so good. It's really about the serious responsibility of pursuing and executing the work to the highest level. And there's a very deep sense of pride in that, an accomplishment. The accomplishment that I assume any of these artists and composers felt when they themselves were accomplishing their own craft.
Hershey, what makes a story work so that it is more than a review by a great talent playing the music of this person? How do you make it so it is your own? And how does the story get framed, specifically when you're playing Irving Berlin?
The framing point of the story is a very old man who has landed up in a very unhappy place, and the question is why. How we do it is a little bit magical, but that's the problem of the play, is you have this man who's 101 years old, which is how old he lived, and he's extremely unhappy about his life and extremely unhappy about what happened. And this is true. It's based on truth, you know? And I always look at truth to tell stories. That's what makes them exciting. If there's a relevance to the truth, then the story will work. How it's done is specific. You know, sometimes the piano leads, sometimes the story leads. It really depends. You know, it's organic, and it has to be.
How long does it take it to become organic? How long does it take for you to embody this performer?
Well, you know, it's 2 years in your whole life. It's you study and you study, but it's your whole life that guides you to learn how to do these things to begin with. And the thing is, you never stop learning. Every performance has got to be both a performance and a learning session. It's just got to get better, and you keep on setting the bar higher and higher. This is not something where you rest on your laurels, say, oh, I've done it, this is what it is, and I'm going to lock it in, and boom, push the button, and you go. Every night is a challenge, a good challenge. Every night is demanding one to be on their toes, and every night one has to deliver 1,000%. There are people out there with tickets. You know, hard-earned money, they paid for their tickets, and you have a responsibility, so you got to do it. And doing it means always continuing to push to get better.
In playing Irving Berlin, did you discover any hidden gems, any pieces of music that you really grew to love?
Well, there's a lot of them that one likes because, you come across them and you go, God, that's magic. I discovered for myself, Supper Time. No idea why it was written. The harmonies in it are remarkable. If you look at Counterbessings instead of Sheep, what a miraculous little song, you know, and an ABA section. He has the whole world. It's just, you know, he was a genius. There's no question.
Performer Hershey Felder. He has portrayed George Gershwin, Beethoven, and Chopin in the past, and now he's in Arizona Theater Company's production as Irving Berlin. The show starts tomorrow and runs through October the 25th. And that's all for today's edition of KJZZ's Here and Now. Thanks very much to senior producer Sarah Ventry and Bruce Drummond for their help, and thank you very much for listening. If you missed our conversations about K-12 education funding or Sheriff Joe Arpaio or the AZ Art Worker Initiative and want to share them with others, go online to our website later this afternoon, kjzz.org. You can also download the free KJZZ app to your smartphone to catch some of our past programs. NPR's Here and Now is next on member-supported KJZZ FM Phoenix and HD. Then we'll have the BBC at 1, the World at 2, and I'll connect with you again this afternoon at 3 for All Things Considered. I'm Steve Goldstein. Have a great rest of the day. It's 12 o'clock.
KJZZ is supported by Honor Health. Still locally owned and not-for-profit, Scottsdale Healthcare and John C. Lincoln Health Network have merged and are making healthy personal. More information can be found at honorhealth.com.